Okay, so the great stages of the path, yes, the theme of our next 5 years starting 2010. So the first thing, before I say what the great stages of the path are, the first thing I want to say, just in a way as an introduction, is to look at why we have a path at all, the importance of having a path, the importance of having a spiritual path, and why Buddhism puts such great stake on the notion of a path. Buddhism is, if anything, a path towards greater and greater expansive and more positive degrees of consciousness, leading to ultimate liberation experienced by the Buddha. So the path, I mean, there are many formulations of the path in Buddhism, but they all have that underlying common purpose and root, and their method. They're methods, they're not doctrine, they're methods. And this is one such method. And as Subhadramati says, Bhante said that it's a very, very comprehensive formulation, this particular formulation. And it goes right back to early Indian Buddhism, although Bhante Sangharakshita has modified and adapted it and made it more relevant for us. But the point about the path that I want to make is that it's not random. It's not random. And perhaps that's obvious to you, but I think in Western Buddhist, well, in Western spiritual circles, there's a sense sometimes that some people think that we don't need a path, that spirituality is all about just spontaneously being. Yeah? I don't know what sort of being, just being, is what it's all about. Certainly this was my view when I first encountered Buddhism. I encountered Buddhism as a teenager. By the time I was 18 or 19, I thought of myself as a Buddhist. I thought of myself particularly as a Zen Buddhist, although I hadn't really encountered much Zen. I'd read a few books and I thought of myself as a Zen Buddhist, and I was convinced that Zen Buddhism was just about just being with the washing up, just being with what you were doing. Certainly it wasn't about ethics. Zen was beyond such kind of playground stuff as trying to be more skillful or ethical. It was just about being really true and being with what was. So as a student, I did join a Zen Buddhist group, and there was no path. In retrospect, that's what stands out. There was no path. We did used to meet once a month at this Zen teacher's house, but he wouldn't teach us anything. We would all go around and say how we'd been during the month. How carefully we'd been able to be with our experience or not. And I'd always say, well, I haven't been very good. And he'd sort of nod sagely. And then we'd meet again in a month's time. And this carried on for the best part of a year for me, until I gave up. Because I didn't really think that Buddhism was wrong, because I was completely convinced by Zen Buddhism, what I'd read about it, but I gave up on myself. I thought, this is just too difficult. I don't know what I'm doing. I used to have this weird notion that I could do what I liked as long as I did it with awareness. So I would get drunk fairly often and think that that was fine. I was still being a Zen Buddhist because I knew that I was getting drunk. I can remember one night cycling home and crashing and falling into a skip. I was riding without lights, without real brakes, in the dark, in the wet, and this shape loomed up. And I saw it, and I knew what it was, but the coordination didn't work, and I just went straight into it, up a sandbank and into the skip. And for me, somehow that's become a metaphor for the spiritual life lived thus. So I think a path, it wasn't until I encountered the FWBO, which is no longer the FWBO, by the way, it wasn't until I encountered our movement that I realised that, no, you could do something to develop spiritually, that it was in my hands, that there were practical, real practical, ordinary things to do. They weren't necessarily straightforward and simple, but they were possible. And one of the things a path implies is that there's always a next step. Buddhism has an ideal that is almost impossibly lofty. At least that's sometimes what it seems to me. But that's the nature of ideals. It's the nature of an ideal to always give you a next step. It's about always treading the path, and it's not so much about the arriving. So yes, the importance of a path. This formulation has five paths, and you can see them as five separate paths, or you can see them as, well, you can see them as consecutive stages, or you can see them as a sort of mandala, as five limbs of a fully lived spiritual life. I'm going to go through them in their normal sort of sequential form. So the five great stages of the path, they are integration. Sometimes that's also glossed as mindfulness, but I'm going to talk about it mainly as integration. Positive emotion is the next stage. The third stage is spiritual death or vision, the path of vision. The fourth stage is spiritual rebirth or transformation. And the fifth stage is compassionate activity. So as I go through them, I think they'll unfold in that order. If you want to look up the references that Bante gave, he gave a seminar in 96 on a text called The Precious Garland, and he refers to these great stages in that seminar in 76. And in then 78, he gave a lecture on the system of meditation in our order and movement. And again, they're related. That system of meditation is very, very closely related to the five great stages of the path. So what I'm going to do is just go through those five stages. The first one is, of course, integration. And that's the stage that we'll be exploring in more depth this year, in 2010. So I'm just going to be able to give an overview in the time that I've got of these stages. So what does integration mean? Well, integration in this context has a very specific connotation. It has the connotation of gathering ourselves, of collecting ourselves around an ideal, around an ideal towards which we move and towards which we commit ourselves. So it's integration, gathering the whole of our being around a common, a single ideal or purpose. So it's movement in a particular direction. Traditionally, in the Indian tradition, this stage was referred to as Sambara. And what Sambara literally translated as was collecting wholesome qualities, collecting wholesome qualities. So you could say gathering skillful qualities within ourselves, developing skillful, wholesome qualities within ourselves. And that gathering of skillful qualities would have been, would have assumed a definite context. It wouldn't have been done in the abstract. It would have been done in a definite context. And the context would have been that you find a teacher. You find a teacher. And then you study the Dharma under that teacher. And you gather wholesome qualities according to the teaching that you study. And you make a commitment to that teaching. So you commit yourself to the ideal. You go for refuge to the ideal. You go for refuge to the Tri Ratna. So integration had a whole sort of context around it, and a connotation that meant much more than just psychological integration. That's not to say it doesn't include psychological integration. It does include psychological integration. And I and probably most of us need more psychological integration. I particularly need it in the mornings when I want to get out of bed and I don't want to get out of bed and I feel like I'm definitely split. Well, I won't tell you which part of my psyche normally wins. Well, they both sort of battle it out, don't they? So psychological integration is a good thing. But that's only the in a way, the starting point for spiritual integration. Because integration as part of the five great stages is not just integration of the mind, of the psyche on its own level. It has a vertical dimension to it. Consciousness has depth to it. Consciousness has height to it. It has potentiality to it that is far beyond our normal waking experience. And integration is about integrating those heights and those depths as well as the breadth of our experience together. So it's a particular spiritual integration. It's about integrating ourselves not just with wholesome qualities like metta and generosity, dana. It's about integrating ourselves with Buddha qualities, enlightened qualities like wisdom and maha karuna, compassion and energy. So that vertical dimension is really, really important. And in this year of integration, that vertical dimension is going to be symbolised at the LBC by the image of Padmasambhava, by this image of Padmasambhava. Padmasambhava, as Maitreya Vandu says, is particularly associated with transformation of all of our psychic energies so that they become in the service of the Dharma, and particularly transformation of the difficult, darker parts of ourselves, the intransigent, hidden, shadowy depths of ourselves that don't really want to practice. Yeah, Padmasambhava is somehow a magician. He's an alchemist. He enables those darker energies to be harnessed rather than suppressed or ignored or hidden. He brings them into the light and he transforms them. He enables us to transform them into pure love and pure wisdom. He's actually the embodiment of love, but it's love with a definite challenge. It's not a sort of flabby sentimentality. It's love that says, you and I can be more than we are, and just because we can be more, we ought to be more. There's a challenge in that. Just because we can be more, we ought to be more. So we'll be saying more worshipping more and evoking more Padmasambhava throughout this year. And just chanting that mantra just now, I don't know about you, but it has a very energising, tangible, invigorating effect. And I think if we could just chant that mantra a great deal more this year, it would have a potentially very, very powerful effect. Sometimes I think we underestimate mantra chanting in our movement. Maybe we can do something about that. The power of mantra chanting. It's a practice in its own right. Subhuti was recently talking, Subhuti, our president at the centre, was recently talking about integration in other terms. He was talking about this great stage of integration as being, as referring to making merit. So merit, or punya in Buddhism, is seen as the effect of skillful action, a skillful karma, punya karma, as it's called. So you act from a skillful mind, from a mind that's filled with altruism, with kindness, with generosity, with contentment, a sort of unegotistical, unself-centered a view of the world, and a perspective that's broader, that not deluded. You act from that, and you experience the fruits of that as punya. There are fruits of that, they're positive fruits of that, and you experience those fruits as punya. And what Subhuti was saying is that the fruits of skillful action are that we become more integrated. Yeah? So the path of integration is about skillful action, it's about ethics. And the fruit of that ethical practice is that we become more integrated. We become more integrated in that horizontal, that psychological sense. We become more integrated in that vertical dimension, which seems to be totally other to our normal experience. What Subhuti was saying is that our consciousness is like a stream. It's a powerful stream, like a torrent. And it's got a momentum. It's got a momentum that's born of our previous actions, that's born of our past actions. And if we want to grow, if we want to purify our stream of consciousness, then we can do so by acting skillfully now. And on the basis of skillful action now, the future stream of consciousness that arises will be a purer stream. Yeah? So in a sense, what that does is it gives us back the imperative, the initiative, to act. The spiritual life, from a Buddhist perspective, is not so much about how we feel right now. We might be feeling grotty right now, but we always have the choice as to whether we're going to take that feeling, whatever it is, painful, pleasant, or not, and act in a way that will lead to a purer stream of consciousness in the future, that will lead to a more integrated psyche, that will lead to a bigger human being in the future. So it's sort of future-oriented in that sense. It's a forwards approach rather than a backwards-looking approach. And again, I think that's important because in the West particularly, when we think of integration, and particularly if we think of psychological integration, often that involves looking back on our lives and working out what went wrong and making it more conscious. And I think that does have real value. I think it has real value because it can bring to light things that have just lain in the shadows. And until they've been brought into light, there's not much chance for transformation. So it has real value. But the emphasis of the Buddhist path is to look forward, is to say, okay, well, this is my psyche, my mind, my consciousness, my stream of consciousness now. How can I cause it to arise in a purer, brighter, bigger form in the next moment? Yeah. And every moment, there's a choice about that. So yes, Subhuti was saying that the whole form and structure and quality of mind, of our mind, is largely formed by our karmic actions of the past, our volitional actions of body, of speech, and of mind. Because our thoughts, the volitional thoughts, the volitions, are seen as actions. So if we're going to integrate, if we're going to follow this path of integration, it's not going to be done simply through coming to a class once a week and then forgetting about our practice the rest of the time, the rest of the however many hours there are in the week. It's not going to work like that. If we're going to actually purify this torrent of consciousness that traditionally has flowed for lifetimes, if we're going to stand a chance of changing that flow into a more positive direction, then we're going to have to let the Dharma touch every aspect of our lives. We're going to have to let it touch every aspect of our lives. So for many of us, for all of us probably, and I include myself, there are aspects of our lives where the Dharma doesn't touch. Yeah? If I'm honest, there are aspects of my life that the Dharma doesn't touch. I'd like to think that that wasn't the case, but it is the case. I was just saying in my community earlier on that Doctor Who Part 2, The Regeneration from whatever, has just come back onto BBC iPlayer. It's been missing for a while from BBC iPlayer, and I said, when I go home tonight after the talk, I'm going to watch Doctor Who. And it's a definite... I mean, there's nothing wrong with Doctor Who, as I'm sure you'll agree. And I recommend it. At the same time, it's not particularly going to be conducive for me getting up tomorrow morning for the 7 o'clock meditation, etc. Yeah. It's an aspect of my life in a way that isn't integrated. Not horrendous, and I'm not, going to go into guilt about it, etc. So all aspects of our lives. So some of you were on the winter retreat. Some of you were on the team, as I was, and Subhadramathi was, and many, Maitreya Bandhu, and many of you here were on the team of the recent winter retreat. And when you're on the team of the winter retreat, all aspects of your life are concerned with the Dharma. There is no time for anything else. I mean, there is a little bit of time for sleep, but not much. And there isn't much time for anything else. I mean, the cooks would sometimes have no time even for, for having a shower. They'd be, scrabbling around. Canute decided not to shave because it was easier. So the cooks, that doesn't, I know, sound like a great advert for the cooking. The food was delicious and healthy. But when you're on the team, there's no time for anything else. And what I experience is that for 10 days, for 2 weeks while I'm on the team, I feel incredibly fulfilled. I feel alive in a way that I seldom do in London. And it's because, in a way, all aspects of my life are involved in the Dharma, and it has an integrating effect. And what's more, it's not just that it has an integrating effect on me, it creates Sangha. It has an integrating effect that goes beyond any one of us. It creates a community that is united, that is integrated. And that is incredibly potent and powerful and fulfilling and meaningful. I sometimes think that the team benefit more than anybody else on that retreat, and that we should be paying people to come on the retreat so that we can run the retreat for them, because it has such a powerful effect. So back in London, life isn't going to be like that, and nevertheless, I think we have to do what we can. And I think at the LBC we're particularly fortunate in this regard. I mean, the LBC could be a lot better, it could be a lot bigger, it could be offer a lot more than it currently does. At the same time, it's very, very rich. It's very, very rich. And I've just come back, as I say, from a meeting where I met with around 30 other chairmen and chairwomen from European centres all over the place. Well, Europe. the LBC is our oldest and most established centre, and few other centres can offer the range of ways of getting involved in the Dharma that the LBC can. From just tonight, there's a Mitra study group meeting, I think, in the back of the centre, and downstairs there's an introductory meditation course with about 27 people on it. We had tried to persuade more people to come in here, but it's just as well that we didn't succeed. So just tonight, there's a whole other 35 people doing other things, and that's just in the centre. There's lots and lots of activities that happen in the mandala that aren't in the centre, particularly things like Mitra study. And then there's communities of people living together, and that's increasingly rare, even in our order and movement. And then there's people trying to earn a livelihood together, working together. I'm particularly delighted to see Claudine here. Claudine and Padmalila have just... is Padmalila here? There you are. Claudine and Padmalila have just opened, if you're not aware of it, a new business in the premises where Friends Organic used to be, just down Roman Road, 83 Roman Road, new business, Lama's Pyjamas. So this is the plug for Lama's Pyjamas. If you haven't been to Lama's Pyjamas, well, what have you been doing all week? Lama's Pyjamas is our new London Buddhist Centre charity shop, And I just went in there yesterday for the first time because I was up in Scotland until then. And I was just delighted. It's fantastic. They do need clothes, and they do need volunteers, and they do need help. Many people have already helped, but it's a way of getting involved. That's not the only way of getting involved. There's much that we can do around the centre. But particularly if you're relatively new to the centre, the culture here, the ethos here, is of getting involved as much or as little as you want to. So it's, you're free not to, but the opportunities to get involved are precious. And I've found that the more I get involved, the more integrated my life feels, the more integrated my psyche feels. So I'm not going to say much more about integration. Maitre Bandhu and Subhadramati are currently doing a seminar on Monday nights that some of you already know about, where they're going to be exploring integration. They're going to be exploring mindfulness, because mindfulness is a key part of integration. It's a key sort of aspect to how we integrate our psyche. So they're going to be exploring mindfulness and integration in more depth over the coming weeks on a Monday at Dharma Night. In the system of meditation lecture, what Bhante does is he links different meditation practices to these different stages of the path. And it's not that that meditation practice is limited to that stage of the path, and it's not that it's the only meditation practice that applies to that stage of the path, but a particular meditation practice can typify a particular stage of the path. In a sense, each stage of the path is unlimited. It contains all the other stages. If you follow integration far enough, you'll get to positive emotion, spiritual death, etc., etc. But the meditation practice that's particularly associated by Sangharakshita with integration is the mindfulness of breathing. Yeah? It's the mindfulness of breathing. So when we teach the mindfulness of breathing, one thing that we don't say is that this is a doorway into the vast, great stage of the path called integration. Yeah? But it is. That's what it is. Okay, but I'm going to move on. So the second stage is positive emotion. Let me just read you something that Teilhard de Chardin, the French philosopher and Jesuit priest, said. Love alone can unite living beings so as to complete and fulfill them. For it alone joins them by what is deepest in themselves. All we need is to imagine our ability to love developing until it embraces the totality of mankind and the earth. Yeah. What a beautiful template for the Metta Bhavana. This great stage of positive emotion follows on from integration, and the emphasis is on Metta. Metta and the other Brahma Viharas, which I'll perhaps touch on. In a certain sense, as I was just saying earlier, if we could really, really practice integration, then positive emotion would be a natural flowering, a natural fruit. But typically, we don't practice any of these stages in isolation. We practice them together. And positive emotion, typified by the Metta Bhavana, is something that goes hand in hand with integration and mindfulness. So as well as metta, as well as friendliness, there's the other Brahma Viharas. So it's said that when metta meets happiness, when it meets joy, there's an arising of sympathetic joy, of mudita, a celebration of the joy of others, yeah? A rejoicing in the happiness of others. When it meets sorrow, when it meets suffering in the world, what arises is karuna, compassion. And then, when it meets wisdom, when it meets a dharmic perspective, what arises is something called upekkha, or upeksha, which is sometimes translated as equanimity. But it's not equanimity in the sense of a neutral, not caring much. It's an equanimity that is a vibrant emotional response to whatever arises in the world, coupled with a perspective that's broad enough to contain everything, a wisdom perspective that's broad enough to contain the whole universe. And it's said that when metta meets the vertical dimension, when it meets enlightenment, when it meets Padmasambhava, what arises is faith and devotion, is Shraddha. So metta, in a way, just takes on this spectrum of colours according to the situation it encounters. And one thing, perhaps it's familiar territory to you, but I think it's worth emphasising, is that metta is not the same as happiness. It's not the same as feeling good. Metta might lead to happiness, but it's not the same thing. In a way, it's something that we do. We try and become aware of how we feel, whether that's happiness or pain or something more subtle and neutral. But metta is our creative response to whatever there is, even if what there is pain. It's not about how we feel necessarily, although how we feel, acknowledging how we feel with kindness, is an essential part of a creative response to that. I think the reason I'm emphasising this is that, well, I was talking with Maitreya Bandhu earlier, and we were saying that somehow, particularly perhaps in the West, we need to regain our faith that actions have consequences and that we can change through our own actions. We need to regain our faith in ourselves as this stream of psychophysical energy that's always moving and is fluid and therefore can change. We're not a fixed self. We're not a given that was just given to us by our parents or by our genes or whatever. We can change. And we need to regain our faith in that. The central teaching of Buddhism could be summarised as actions having consequences. The other thing I want to emphasise is that we've all got the potential to change. Buddhism is so, so positive in this regard. It's quite realistic in that it's not naive. It's just a realistic positivity that says all of us have the potential to change. All of us have the potential to become Buddhas. In the tradition, there was a lot of debate around that, but most Buddhists have throughout the ages asserted this. I'm reminded of a favourite story of mine that Bante tells in his book on the Noble Eightfold Path, Vision and Transformation. Some of you have heard me tell this before, some of you will be familiar from Bante's lectures, but I'm going to just tell you this story again because I find it so touching. And it's to do with metta. And it's to do with this potential that we all have for change, for metta. And it's about, it's set in Japan, it's a Japanese story. And it's about a young man who has, well, Bante describes him as a wastrel, which is a lovely old fashioned term. A young man who's, I don't know what he might have done, but he's wasted all his money, he's wasted his youth probably, so maybe he's not so young. He's lived a life which is meaningless, and he's feeling worthless about himself. He's feeling worthless. And he decides that the only thing that he can do is enter a Zen monastery. That's now the only sort of refuge that he can think of, because nothing else has worked. Maybe drink and drugs haven't worked. Nothing else has worked in life. So he goes to the Zen monastery, and in the Zen tradition, they don't let you in with open arms when you knock on their door. Traditionally, at least. I don't know what it's like in practice, but traditionally, you have to kneel in the snow for at least 3 days outside the monastery, sort of to show your commitment before they'll take you on. And I think there's something good about that. I do think there's something good about that that maybe we could learn from. Anyway, eventually he's let in, and he goes to the abbot of the monastery, And one thing that this man seems to be is he's very honest, and he just tells the abbot that he's worthless, that he's lived a useless life, he has no skills, and could he just stay at the monastery and become a monk? And the abbot is this sort of rather grim, inscrutable chap who listens very intently to the young man's tale, and then says, well, is there anything that you are good at? And the man pauses and thinks and says, well, I'm not bad at playing chess. I'm not bad at playing chess. And the abbot says, good. And he sends for his attendant and asks his attendant to bring a certain monk into the room and a chessboard. And so this monk arrives, a chessboard is set up, and then the abbot asks for a sword, his sword. And he holds the sword beside him, and he says, I want you to play chess, and whoever loses, I'm going to cut their head off with this sword. And in the Zen tradition, you never know whether they're joking or not. So they start playing chess, and the young man has to really focus. He has to really, really focus. He's playing for his life, literally. And he moves, he makes a move, and there's this old monk in front of him who must have been a monk for 30 or 40 years, this thin, haggard-looking old man, who happens to be not bad at chess, also making a move. And they make these moves, and the perspiration starts to form on this young man's brow and trickle down his back, as he realises that he's got to... Well, he's fighting for his life, he's playing for his life. And he summons, in a way, all his wits about him and manages to beat back on this chessboard the old monk. He beats him back to the point where he knows that he'll win. The young man is going to win. And at that point, he relaxes. There's this sigh of relief as he knows that it's all right. A few moves from now, it'll be checkmate, he'll have won. And it's at that point that he looks at the other man. He looks at the monk, the old monk, in front of him. This monk who's been meditating and living a monastic life for 30, maybe 40 years. And what arises in this young man's mind is pity, compassion, kindness, metta. What arises is this thought that, well, I've lived a useless life. Here's somebody who's lived a noble life. Here's somebody who, for no reason, is willing to lay down his life just because the abbot has demanded it. And I'm completely useless. I've got nothing to offer this world. And there's this wise monk sitting in front of me, willing to die. And what he does is he deliberately makes a false move. He decides that he can't win. I mean, he can't win from... His heart won't let him win. And he makes this false move, and the monk moves, and the young man makes another false move, and the monk moves, and he makes another false move till it's obvious that he's going to lose the game. And at that point, the abbot stands up and throws the board up, scatters all the pieces, and says, no one has lost, no one has won. And then he looks to the young man and he says, today you have learnt two things. You have learnt concentration and you have learnt compassion. Because you've learnt compassion, you'll do. Which is lovely, isn't it? Because you've learnt compassion, you'll do. So for me, that story illustrates that there's potential for metta in all of us. It's there. Sometimes we don't recognise it, and sometimes we don't give it the opportunity to come out because we're so concerned with, in a way, saving our own skin so much of the time that we don't take account of other people. We're not aware enough. We don't even see them. And how can the metta flow if we're not aware? Metta is so much to do with our relationship to others. It so requires us to be aware of other people as human beings. Thank you. So the first two stages of integration and positive emotion, I'm not going to say much more about either of those, apart from to say that they're a foundation. They're an essential foundation. They're a foundation for living a healthy human life, and they're a foundation for living a spiritual life that goes beyond them. Yeah? Because the spiritual life does go beyond them. Because the next stage is spiritual death, or the stage of vision. So we've established by this stage, hopefully, a mind that is bright and integrated and positive and kindly and clear and limpid and flexible and skillful. We've established that. It's on that basis of a positive and integrated self that we can glimpse reality, that we can have a taste of perfect vision. And there are some other things, other conditions that need to come into play if we're going to have that glimpse, at least if we're not going to rely on some random good fortune to have that glimpse. Those other conditions, there are many ways of talking about them. I'm going to talk about them in two ways. The first is that on the basis of that positive mind, we need intelligent reflection. We need intelligent reflection. And that reflection, by reflection, I don't just mean thinking about something up here at cognitive level. I don't mean that sort of intelligence, and I don't mean that sort of reflection. What I mean is a deep, heartfelt yearning for more. Yeah? For more in life. A deep, heartfelt dissatisfaction with our current experience, our current limited experience, even though by this stage our limited experience might be really positive and integrated. Yeah? But a deep dissatisfaction that that's not enough. A yearning for more. A yearning for truth. A yearning for something higher. And we really need that deep dissatisfaction if we're going to carry on. Because at this stage, it's all right to... it's very easy. It's not all right. It's very easy to settle into a comfortable, lukewarm, dharmic existence. It's very easy to do that. C.S. Lewis once said, if you look for truth, you may find comfort in the end. If you look for comfort, you will not get either comfort or truth. Only soft soap and wishful thinking to begin with, and in the end, despair. Only soft soap and wishful thinking to begin with, and in the end, despair. So that's really what I'm trying to get at, that it's not enough even to have an integrated and positive mind if all we're going to do with that mind is then become comfortable. So we need that deep dissatisfaction. And the third, or the second condition that we bring to this mind, is we need to reflect in dharmic terms. We need to reflect on our experience in dharmic terms. In particular, we need to reflect on the nature of reality, on the nature of experience, on the nature of mind in dharmic terms. Theoretically, we might discover the Dharma for ourselves, after all the Buddha did, but in practice, you'd have to be an exceptionally gifted spiritual individual to discover it for yourselves. And besides, you don't have to, because the Buddha did. So we need to reflect on, for example, the lakshanas, the impermanence of all things, the inherent suffering in all things, and the insubstantiality of all things. We need to learn to reflect with a mind that is deeply dissatisfied and yearning for truth, at the same time is deeply positive and open and bright and prepared to die, prepared to let go. This stage of spiritual death is a stage of letting go of everything that we've ever held to in our psyche. It's a stage of being prepared to be that young man playing chess and deciding that he would let go of his life for the sake of another person out of kindness. It's that sort of mind, that sort of intensity that is going to be required if we're going to open up to something bigger. Because it's the holding on, the attachment in our mind that causes the narrowing. that causes the narrowing of consciousness. It's the letting go of the holding on that allows the breadth and the freedom and the openness to emerge. And it's an openness that has no boundary, no limit. It's infinite, it's indefinite, it's openness, complete openness. So that's hard to imagine. So I can, for example, be more or less open. I can be more or less generous, more or less other-regarding, more or less kind, while still having a strong sense of myself as being the centre of the universe. Yeah. But this isn't about that. This is about letting go of ourselves as the centre of anything, as the centre of life. It's as the centre of the universe, letting go of any notion of who we are at all. It really is being prepared to die. And then what happens is something magical. Then what happens is that there's room in what we allow for something like Padmasambhava to descend. It feels like grace. It feels like something descends from the outside because it's so unfamiliar. It's so unlike any state of mind that we've ever experienced before. In fact, it's not like an experience at all. Normally, we're concerned, aren't we, with having particular experiences. We're having... We live our lives wanting pleasurable or good experiences or satisfying experiences. That's how we... That is almost always the raison d'etre of our being. Well, this is about even letting go of that. It's not about having an experience, it's about seeing into the very nature of experience itself. It's about letting go of a sense of self entirely. From a Buddhist perspective, that self was never there, that sense of self was a delusion. So it's about letting go of delusion. And it is a kind of dying. And the practice that Bhante particularly associates with the stage of spiritual death is the six-element practice. And the six-element practice and this stage of spiritual death is only taught to those just about to get ordained. So if you want to learn about the spiritual six-element practice, well, you have to ask for ordination. And then you have to make the commitment that allows you to move towards ordination, and then you'll be taught the six-element practice, because it's only on the basis of having an integrated, positive psyche that is prepared to die, that is prepared to commit to something higher than itself, does the six-element practice even have any relevance, let alone a positive outcome. The reason I emphasise that, knowing that many of you aren't ordained, the reason I emphasise that is not to try and pressurise you into asking for ordination or feeling that you have to get ordained, but because sometimes people ask me, what is the FWBO's, which isn't the FWBO's, spiritual discipline? What is the spiritual path? If you're only familiar with practices like the mindfulness and metta, and with ethics, you can think that that's all there is. But actually, when somebody is ordained into the Triratna Buddhist order, you are introduced to another dimension. And it's in that other dimension, in the context of those other practices, that the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana really find their home, and ethics really finds its home. And everything sort of comes together. It's in the context of all five stages. That's not to say that the stages of integration and positive emotion are not valid or valuable in their own right. Okay. So I'm going to move a bit more quickly through spiritual rebirth and the last stage. So spiritual rebirth is, in a way, what happens when you are prepared to undergo spiritual death. When you are prepared to walk through the fires of shunyata, what emerges is not you, but some other being, a bigger being. And it's referred to as spiritual rebirth. It's also referred to as the stage of transformation, because it's when that vision, this is the stage when that vision, that glimpse of enlightenment, when it descends, that vision descends into all aspects of our being. It descends and transforms every aspect of our being. it's said to be the transcendental path beginning at that stage, at the stage of spiritual rebirth. It's said that that's when the bodhicitta arises. I'm not going to explain what that means. Some of you may already know. Some of you may find out in due course. It's said that that's when the bodhicitta arises. And it's associated in our system of practice with visualising Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in a meditation practice called a sadhana practice that you're given at ordination time. At ordination, you're introduced to a particular figure like Padmasambhava, an archetypal figure like Padmasambhava, and you're given that figure's mantra. So spiritual rebirth. And then I'm going to say just a few words about the last stage. So now we're looking ahead to 2016, probably. Compassionate activity. It's also sometimes referred to as spontaneous compassionate activity, to differentiate from the stage of positive emotion where I was talking about metta and kindness. This is spontaneous compassionate activity that is an overflow, an expression, an overspilling of the enlightened mind. The enlightened mind is like this enormously powerful stream, this current, this fountain of energy and positivity that overflows and spontaneously acts in the world as play. The activity of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is known as play. It's a translation of a term, a beautiful word called lila. So the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas don't try to be compassionate. They just play. They play with reality. We experience that play, those of us who are yet to be enlightened, we experience that play as compassion, because it reaches out to us and it lifts us up and it shows us the way, it opens doors, and we experience that as compassion. And it's this, in a way, that is said to be the culmination of the path. It's referred to as the stage of nishta, or completion of fulfillment. And it's this that the world so desperately needs. It's this compassion that is the spontaneous play, the overflowing of the wisdom of the enlightened mind. That's what the world so desperately needs. And it can't wait. The world won't wait. It won't wait till 2016 even for us to start responding or trying to respond in this way. Just coming back from Scotland, I was listening to the radio and heard about Haiti. And within, it's sort of unspeakable horror in a way, isn't it? Within moments, you have tens of thousands of people killed, and possibly hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people bereaved, made homeless, desperate. And in a way, if Haiti were some sort of isolated incident that, you know, never happens again, it would still be bad enough. But there are Haitis happening all the time. Maybe not as dramatic and as awful in their scale and their magnitude, but they're happening all the time. The Buddhist vision is that we're all in a desperate situation. We're all in this burning house, and we don't realise it. We don't realise our human predicament, but we're all in the clutches of suffering and death. And there is a way out, and that's why it's tragic. If there was no way out, perhaps you would say, you'd be stoic and you'd say, oh well, let's make the best of it, let's grit our teeth, make the best of it. We might even choose to harden our hearts, but there is a way out, and that makes it tragic. That makes the human situation tragic unless we choose to not only find the way out, but to open the door for as many other people as we can. It is our duty as men and women to proceed as though the limits of our abilities do not exist. It is our duty as men and women to proceed as though the limits of our abilities do not exist. That's Teilhard de Chardin again. And I just think that we can't wait. We can't wait. If we'd never encountered the Dharma, this is how I feel. If I'd never encountered the Dharma, if I'd carried on being a pseudo-Buddhist riding into skips, maybe that would have been forgivable. In a certain sense, it would have been a shame. In another sense, maybe it would have been forgivable. But once I'd encountered the Dharma, once I know in my own bones that there is a way out, that actually that way out involves this integration, this positive emotion, this altruism that's willing to die, this letting go, this rebirth into a realm, into a mind stream that is beyond all concepts and comprehension, but nevertheless is possible and tangible, and an overflowing of that that can help the world. If I didn't know that, maybe it would have been all right. But once you know that, there's an imperative, there's a duty. There's a duty to act as if all our limitations didn't exist. I feel that. I really, really want the LBC Mandala, I want us as a Sangha to do what we can. The world so needs us. I know we're not alone in trying to do good in the world. We're not the only Buddhist centre, we're not the only Buddhist movement, and Buddhism isn't the only religion or spiritual discipline or altruistic activity. In a way, we're tiny, aren't we? We're tiny. We're a tiny little flame burning in the eastern part of a city in a small country. But the potential for what we've got is vast. The potential is vast. The potential of that tiny flame is vast. Flames can light other flames without dying out, and they can start a fire. And we're on the edge of one of the largest, most cosmopolitan cities in the world, one of the most privileged cities in the world. And most of the time, our culture denies that. Our culture just tells us to go shopping. And we really, really need to wake up. We really need to wake up. We need to take the next step. We need to be a beacon of light that is more than just a tiny flame. We need to become a torch, a fire, a blazing fire. We need to be what Bhante envisaged when he founded this movement and this order. He wanted us to be a force for good in the world. Thank you.